Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia, solartopia, solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know?
Yeah.
Started to burn too many things we found. That's the magnificent Dara Williams singing with Pete Seeger and David Burns, who wrote most of the words to that song, except for the word Solartopia, which I wrote. I'm Harvey Sluggo Wasserman, back with you at PRN for another scintillating hour here in the Green Power and Wellness Show. We're going to be talking about election protection. I have two spectacular guests with us. John Brakey. John, you with us? And Steve Rosenfeld, you with us? Neither guy is with us yet. Well, we'll see what we can do. I guess I'll have to email them. We're going to talk about election theft. There was just a major conference in Oakland, California, on the theft of our elections. But first, while I got a chance here, let's talk about the impeachment. And hold on here, I'm going to email these two guys, Bob, John, and Steve Rosenfeld. Waiting for you guys. 888-874-4888. Okay. So there's a whole lot of talk now about impeachment, of course, and I actually met Adam Schiff last week. He seems like a nice guy, but I think the Democrats are blowing it, as always. They will blow it. They're going to wind up ensconcing Donald Trump for life. The corporate Democrats simply have no, let's say, oomph, and no power, no push when it comes to dealing with these a dictator like Donald Trump. And you know, they're talking about impeaching him. They're talking about all sorts of minor details, infractions, calls to the Ukraine, all this stuff. The bottom line is, if they don't have a piece of evidence of a crime that the American people can relate to, then you know, we're screwed, because the American public is not going to care all that much about whether Donald Trump made a call about Joe Biden to the president of Ukraine. What they're going to care about is stuff that really affects them. I mean, we had Richard Nixon, who went down because of what he called a third-rate burglary at the Watergate, and it was a third-rate burglary. And clearly he broke the law. He engaged in a cover-up. He lied, lied, lied. All that stuff that we know that Richard Nixon did. And yet, you know, and it did bring him down, but that's not what brought him down. What brought Richard Nixon down was the war in Vietnam. And, you know, the horrific murder and waste of resources and death and destruction that was perpetrated by Richard Nixon. You know, that's what brought Richard Nixon down. And the bottom line is that he committed treason. You know, treason in 1968, when Nixon sabotaged the elections by sabotaging the peace talks with the Vietnamese and prolonging the war. That's what brought Richard Nixon down. So did the bombing of Cambodia. What will bring Donald Trump down is stuff that the people can understand, like money laundering. Money laundering is really the core of Richard Nixon's, of Donald Trump's personal well-being, personal finances. And the bottom line is that in the 1980s, and we've talked about this on the show, Trump was broke, multiple bankruptcies, and he turned the one place where he could get all the money he needed, which was to Russia, to the Russian mob. And you got to remember, of course, we all know that Donald Trump is a mobster. He was raised in a mob family. His father did business with the five families of the mob in New York, and that's how Fred Trump built his tenements with mob money, with the Gambini and Genovese families, and that's how it happened. Guys, and Jesse in the studio, John Brakey's phone number is 520-339-2696. Give him a call if you would. 520-339-2696. Fred Trump was a mobster. This is Donald's father. He was a slumlord. He was a racist. He supported the Ku Klux Klan very openly, very proudly. But the bottom line is he was a mobster. He could not have built. The line is, you don't pour concrete in New York City without the mob. And Fred Trump was hand and fist with the mob, did everything he could to have mob support. He had a mob lawyer, Roy Cohn, and Donald grew up in a mob household. Simple as that. Same with his grandfather. Trump's grandfather ran a brothel, a human trafficking business in California. And, he was a mobster, too. Now, when Donald inherited his fortune, his real estate, from his father, he, of course, immediately went bankrupt. He had no business ability whatsoever and still doesn't. Bottom line is that he went bankrupt and had no money. And what happened? Well, he turned to the Russian mob. And here's how it worked. In the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union was falling in the 1980s and 90s. Gorbachev came in, opened things up, and he also opened up the gulags. And when the gulags opened up, mobsters came out. These young guys in the prison system, and these guys were criminals. They weren't like dissidents or political activists. These mobsters in the gulag were criminals. And as they came out, they took over the Soviet Union, which turned into Russia in 1991 when the Soviet Union fell. And they made themselves billionaires. And they had all these rubles that they wanted to bring into the American economy. And what they did was they looked around and they found a bankrupt mobster with a ton of real estate named Donald Trump. And they siphoned they took their boatloads of rubles, which is darn near were worthless, brought them into the United States, overpaid Trump billions of rubles for his real estate, and got their money into and their assets into the American economy. That's where Donald Trump's money comes from, and that's who he is, and he has been owned and operated by the Russian mobsters since the 1980s. Then 91 in comes Boris Yeltsin, put in power, by the way, by very proudly by the CIA. Their CIA bragged very openly about having put Boris Yeltsin into power. And Yeltsin was just a buffoon, really, a drunken mafia hack, very low-level guy, very stupid, very boorish, and he takes over what had been the Soviet Union and now is Russia, and let these guys run wild. And so between the fall of the Soviet Union in the 1980s and the decline, and then the fall in the 1990s when it turns into Russia and the place is run by Yeltsin, you've got mobsters running the place. And they make themselves billionaires. And they take their billions of rubles, they bring them into the United States, and they launder them through Donald Trump. And so Trump, in the mid-80s, famously bankrupt, no one will do business with him except Deutsche Bank in Germany, which is a mob operation, or certainly has mob dimensions to it. And he takes the Russian rubles that are being poured into him from the mobsters, and turns his empire over to the Russians. And so through the 80s and 90s, Donald Trump is purchased by the Russian mob with the rubles that bail him out of his multiple bankruptcies. And Trump Tower at 721 Fifth Avenue becomes basically a dormitory for Russian mobsters living on Donald Trump's real estate and bailing him out and basically owning him. So then what happens in 1991, Yeltsin takes over, he runs Russia for the former Soviet Union, that part of it now Russia, until 1999. He handpicks his successor, although I'm sure there were other hands involved, Vladimir Putin. Putin comes into power on December 31st, 1999, and makes himself basically the mob boss of Russia. And he's got all these billionaires running around under him, cracks the whip, makes himself the mafia don, the Don Corleone of Russia. And all these mobsters who have purchased Donald Trump now become beholden to Vladimir Putin. And so all this Russia stuff you've been hearing, all the conspiracy theories about Donald Trump being owned and operated by Vladimir Putin are 100% true. And, you know, a lot of people on the left dismiss the Russia dimension to the theft of our elections as kind of a meaningless conspiracy theory and as a distraction. And in part it is a distraction because we'll hear from John. John, are you on, by the way, John Brakey?
I certainly am, thank you.
Oh, you there? Steve Rosenfeld,
yes.
Are you there?
Yep, I'm here. Hi, Harvey. Hi, John.
Okay, I didn't hear you guys come in. So let me finish this monologue here because we've had this before. You guys may not have heard, but I've had David K. Johnston and Craig Unger, who are the two experts on this. David K. Johnston has followed Trump from the early days, and has written, there's a book he's got, a great title called It's Even Worse Than You Think, about Trump's early days and his father and their roots in the mob. And then Craig Unger has written House of Trump, House of Putin, about Trump's mafia connections to the Russians. And so between these two, we get a very clear picture of Donald Trump, born a mobster, you know, and raised a mobster and carrying on his career as a mobster and then going bankrupt, being bought whole hog by Russian mobsters who then become beholden to Vladimir Putin. I mean, it's simple stuff. And, you know, I tried to raise this with Adam Schiff. He was at a fundraiser in Santa Monica. I told him two things. First of all, I told him, you got to start calling Trump Fredo. And he had, you know, apparently Adam Schiff has not seen the Godfather movie, but, you know, so he didn't get that part. And then, you know, I said, it's all about money laundering. And he didn't seem to know what I was talking about. So I don't have much faith in these Democrats, frankly. And, you know, I'm getting emails from people basically telling me that, you know, they're just going to fold. And this whole impeachment stuff has been so badly handled. And, you know, it's such a farce. Jerry Nadler, I have to say, did come to Ohio in 2004 for our hearing on the stolen elections. And good for him. I thought he was a smart guy. But he's not going anywhere. And Adam Schiff doesn't seem to be going anywhere. And the American public is not going to care about this Ukrainian stuff. So unless some of the Democrats get a bolt of backbone, I'm not sure where we're going. Now, you guys, John Brakey and Steve Rosenfeld, you are the reigning experts on election theft. You just had a conference in Oakland, and my concern is that the Democrats, once again, you guys know everything about what's happening with our electoral system, and that's what this show is going to be about. But my concern is that the Democrats, the corporate Democrats, are still doing nothing. Only one Democrat, mainstream Democrat or major Democrat, has come out having had an election stolen and said the first thing about it, and that's Stacey Abrams in Georgia. And God love her, she's fighting election theft. I actually wish she was running for Senate in Georgia. I hope she'll change her mind and do that. But, you know, tell us, let's start with you, John Brakey. Do you think that the corporate Democratic Party is going to pay any attention to all the spectacular stuff that you and Steve and so many others have dug up about how the 2020 election can be stolen? What is the corporate Democratic response going to be?
That's interesting, because there are individuals coming out and saying things. And Steve's had some luck. I think maybe Steve could be better answering this, because, you know, he has interface. So I'm gonna shift this over to you, Steven.
Well, Steve Rosenfeld, you are writing prolifically about election theft and the rigmarole with all the voting machines and so on. What is your sense of what the corporate Democratic Party is willing and not willing to do to guarantee us a reliable outcome in 2020?
Well, there's not a single answer, because there's not a single election. You know, I'm not trying to be glib. So the Democrats coming out of 2016 wanted to heal the rift between the Clinton and the Sanders camps. And one way that they thought they could do this, and both sides, quite frankly, thought it would serve their interests, was to have what they called virtual caucuses, or which is online voting systems in the non-government-run nominating contests. So caucuses are run by state parties, not by local or state election officials. And what happened was the mainstream Democrats, who you're calling the corporate Democrats, were just appalled that Bernie Sanders was winning caucuses with less than 10% turnout. So they thought that if they had higher turnouts by this virtual voting, that they would basically be able to beat Bernie. And the Bernie people thought that it would be fantastic, because they could out-organize, especially younger people, and they would sweep more caucuses. So both sides were smiling and saying, participation, participation. But what ended up happening was they wrote the Rules Committee. The Democratic National Committee has a panel called the Rules and Bylaws Committee, and they write the rules. They're the judges or the umpires for the different state nominating contests. So they wrote these rules saying we're going to have in caucuses internet voting, we're going to have paper trails, we're going to have voter verified systems. They had all the language. And then what happened was, I started writing a lot of articles about this last winter, about what this really meant. And it turns out, just to jump to the conclusion, that they couldn't build these systems. They had to get them from vendors. Vendors overpromised. They didn't deliver. There were so many moving parts that could not be evaluated. And even if they were all on the table, and they weren't, they still had to be evaluated for security and reliability. And so what ended up happening was I wrote all these articles. There were people who were at the Rules Committee who were reasonable. They then went and got third-party advice, meaning real technology people, who told them this was nuts. They said that there was no bigger target for 2020 election theft than these non-governmental contests in Iowa and Nevada. If you want to mess with the nominating contest, start with the number one and the number three race. And they pulled the plug on it. So that actually, this happened in the last couple of weeks, and that actually was a good thing. You talk about corporate Democrats. Well, you know, Tom Perez, the state, you know, the DNC chair, he was putting out press releases saying we're going to have these virtual caucuses and everything's going to be fine and just go away. But it turns out that other people in the party sort of weighed in. And, you know, you have to give credit where credit is due. Now, when you take a look out at the states, and this is where, like, John comes in, and I've seen this, too, with my reporting, you know, every state is its own little microcosm. And even in states like North Carolina or Pennsylvania, where you have Democrats in the governor's mansion, you have very big questions being raised around, what new voting systems are being acquired and how transparent and accountable and believable they are. And what we mean by transparent and accountable and believable is literally, you know, what does the voter see when they cast their votes, and what do people at the finish line see when they try to count them in the closest contests? It's all about the ballot. What is the ballot? And in a lot of places across America, computers are being asked to mark ballots rather than having people do it, and the computer is doing the counting, and the officials are saying everything's fine, just trust us, and don't worry about it. And, you know, we know better because we just know that elections are never that smooth, and the public certainly is skeptical. So I'll stop here. But so, you know, when you talk about corporate Dems, well, you know, at the national level, you had some good news. There were some people who are reasonable. You have a lot of swing states where things are not as reasonable. It's hard to generalize because everyone's in a different level and in a different bubble. And, you know, John, you know, does this line up with what you've seen?
No, I agree. I mean, that's the whole point. I mean, after Hillary Clinton came out and quoted, Jennifer Cohen and right. came out with her position, it is like, you know, it's a big elephant and we're all blind and somebody's grabbing the ass and maybe I'm grabbing something else and maybe got it confused with the nose. I don't want to paint everybody being the same. It's like we're all living as tribes with different beliefs, with getting different information. All I know, the game has changed after 2006, and people are waking up because they keep hammering it. And it's just a matter of keep going after. It's like what Dr. Spearman, you know, said to in a group meeting in Florida. He says, you know, I sit on a board of elections, and people come in after I make that decision, and they say, how could you make that decision, Dr. Spearman? And he turns around and says, because you were not here beforehand to get me informed. And that's a responsibility that we all have. And saying that they're not listening, you're all corporate Dems. Some are, some aren't. We have to keep trying because this is the big one coming. I mean, would you agree with that, Harvey?
Absolutely. Clear up real quickly. Who is Jennifer Cohen and why is it significant that Hillary Clinton quoted her?
She's a person who's really gotten big on Twitter. She tweets, and she has 100,000 followers, and she specializes only in elections.
Yeah, she's a former
And she's starting
lawyer.
To get a pretty big following, and people are looking into things, and seeing it. That's how she's done a really good job.
Steve,
she's a non-practicing lawyer. She got into this whole thing, and this was really, really interesting. Hillary Clinton gave this – she gave like two speeches wrapped in one about a week and a half ago. I was with John in North Carolina, and I had to sort of spend the morning listening and writing this thing up. And she basically – this is really astounding, Harvey. I mean, she basically said everything you would have hoped she would have said in November 2016. I mean, we know that this happens so frequently, you know, when the game is hot, when the action has not been decided, you know, silence. But basically she said that, and she pointed to what happened in Georgia with Stacey Abrams, and she just basically said that, you know, there's just real, you know, this voter suppression stuff is as bad as it's ever been in some states, and it's overt, and it's immoral, even if it's legal. And she said that the new voting systems coming online are not good enough. And it was like an astounding declaration that was very in sync with people who she's normally not associated with, to be honest.
So what is she going to do about it? That's the question.
Well, I don't know what she can do about it because she's not in office, quite frankly, unless you're sort of a Clinton, junkie, a lot of people don't pay that much attention to her anymore.
Well, thank God for that. But let's put it this way. Here's the question that we have to ask ourselves. Will there be a fair election in 2020? And, because I think it's a reasonably safe bet that Donald Trump will lose the popular vote. I don't think the Democrats are going to nominate Joe Biden. I think he's on his way down. I love Great. Bernie Sanders. I my guess would be that Elizabeth Warren will get the nomination, and we'll see. But the bottom line is this. You guys are the reigning experts right now in the integrity and the structure and the basic makeup of the American electoral system, mechanically. What is your prognosis for the stealability of the 2020 election by the Republicans at this point in time?
I'll speak up first on that. Okay, it's John Brakey. Is that I am very, very worried. I see that right now they're working as hard as they can to pump these ballot marking devices into states, okay, that are the leftovers of the DREs, meaning that they still have direct recording electronics. They don't want to go hand mark or paper ballot. They want to work hard on protecting the right to cheat by using these machines. It's so much, I don't read barcode like the rest of the people in this country. And I see that there is something going on, and I'm very concerned about the Mitch McConnell money with no strings. To me, that's going to be pumped in for a few or particularly one company to buy, sell a lot of their equipment, which is way overrated, and there may be a scheme involved in all of that or whatever, but it is a severe problem. I think it's very important what we're doing at Audit USA and what we're going to try to do in 14 states, if we can put the funding together, is to go ahead and put tremendous pressure out there to make sure that public records are not destroyed. And, of course, the public records I'm talking about is that these digital scanners, which the first time in history of voting in this country that maybe approximately 80% or more of all ballots going through a machine in this country, even the express vote result sheet will go through a digital scanner, could be 80% or more, and those public records could prove elections. And to me, this is the election that's the most important, that we can prove that the loser really lost. And that were how ballot images could really work, by having elections that are transparent, trackable, and publicly verified. And there's a lot of stake. There's a lot of purging going on. There's all sorts of stuff. And I'm just grateful for people like Steve, who did what he did by confronting the Democratic Party to break up the first part of the plan, which was to get their guy out of the gate real quick by rigging it. And I think that Steve made it harder to do that, even though we have to worry about other plans or other techniques that they'll wind up using. So that's what we're going to do. And we succeeded somewhat in North Carolina, a lot more work to do. We're getting ready to go into Michigan next. We're getting ready to file again litigation in Florida. Half the state's saving it properly. The other half is not. And we're going to keep as aggressively as much as we can afford, and we still don't know what to do about all these ballot marking devices that are getting popped out, except to try to get more public people and keep talking to other people across the country. And that's what that conference, a lot of it was about, is just showing how ESNS has really, to me, put some kind of a scheme together to either do two things. One is
is to sell equipment that is really not needed. I mean, let's face it. They invented a machine that replaces a human being on being able to produce a receipt. And you know, I just used Mecklenburg County. You know, I estimated that if they went with hand-marked paper ballots on a new system, it would cost about $2.4 million, and that if they went with ballot-marking devices, it would cost $9.1 million minimally. I was really wrong. I mean, wow, was I wrong. I hear it's $14 or $15 million, and it's just, wow, what a ripoff with all the problems that happened in Mecklenburg County and the money that's needed for other things and education to throw this kind of money away. This is a big problem, and somebody may be protecting the right to cheat. That's what I'm saying.
See? Over from there.
Yeah, well,
that was
Harvey,
my rant.
I come at it from a slightly different perspective. I don't disagree with anything that you know John is saying. By the way, I think he's right, but let me start with a much bigger picture. You know, across America, we really have like three countries when it comes to voting. We've got blue states, purple states, and red states. And you know, in blue states, it's pretty easy to vote. You have these states have automatic registration. They have online registration. You don't have to show all this voter ID, because if you sign your name when you check in, it's like signing an oath. And if you're lying, you've just signed a confession. You're on your way to court. You know, in red state America, and in purple states, where basically you have these, you know, photo finish races for governor and president, and some of those purple states, you know, for most of this last decade, were run by Republicans because of gerrymandering. But more recently, you have like Republican legislatures and a few Democratic governors. What you've got is a whole different climate for voting, and whole different voting laws and whole different voting rules. So there, the Republicans, because they know that they're demographically being diluted as you know, white America ages out, they know that they've got to basically change the rules if they want to stay in power, and they have been doing it. So what that means is that in those states, and I'm talking, and these happen to be a lot of the presidential swing states. So what am I talking about? I'm talking about, thinking of the map, Florida, Georgia, North Carolina, Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Michigan, increasingly, you know, Texas is headed this way, Arizona, you know, these states, they, for Democrats to win, they have to turn out in disproportionately large numbers, because if it comes to congressional elections, you have gerrymandering, which means that voters are segregated by party so that Republicans can win with like 55% of the vote and Democrats tend to be winning with 65 or 70. And for president, you know, you got to overcome, which are statewide, you got to overcome all these different barriers like stricter ID laws and just things that sort of like chip away a couple percentages at a time. So the thing is this, if we're going to not have, the only good scenario I can see for 2020 is having such a big landslide that you cannot have legal fights that will try to nickel and dime stuff and run out the clock. Because basically, it's a very short clock between election night and when the Electoral College meets. So what happens is, you know, it varies from state to state. You have to have these official returns certified for anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, and the Electoral College is supposed to meet 6 weeks later. Now, that means, you know, Democrats really need to win by, you know, margins that are much closer to 10% than 5%, so that they cannot have these contested fights and recounts. That's a pretty tall order. I mean, we saw some of that wave stuff in 2018, you know, but that's how we got the House back. But that's what it's really going to take. So if it's close, that's when people start getting really freaked out. And I'm not talking about me making this stuff up. So, you know, this fellow who I respect, who's a long-time guy, he's been a lawyer for 60 years. His name is Bert Newborn. He created the Brennan Center. He was the head of the ACLU in the 80s, fighting Reagan. And basically, you know, what you know, his nightmare scenario is there's just two of them. And you know, basically, the first one is that Trump wins legitimately. And then the Supreme Court, Ginsburg and Breyer leave, and he puts people like Giuliani in there. And then he does stuff like, you know, he revokes or suspends habeas corpus and starts ruling by executive order and starts, you know, silencing like fake news outlets and doing all this preventative detention and kind of like moves incrementally to martial law. This is what Burt has in a book that came out this summer. The worst scenario is if Trump loses but somehow then declares, as we've heard him declare before, that the election numbers are fraudulent, you know, millions of undocumented aliens voted. And then, you know, he directs the Attorney General, you know, to investigate widespread fraud, and pending the outcome of that, he declares martial law and detains the apparent Electoral College winner, who is maybe a bewildered Joe Biden. He refuses to let the Electoral College meet. He delays the inauguration. And then it's like, you know, I'm not making this up. This is in Burt's new book, When at Times the Mob is Swayed. So, this is kind of like what we're facing. And the only thing I can think of is super, super high turnouts, because that only that can swamp, you know, these political moves and literally, you know, the inefficiencies or the deficiencies in these new voting systems. And I'm sorry to go on for so long to answer.
No, it's fine. The question is this: how do we stop this? I mean, you can have a massive turnout, but if the registration rules are flipped or stripped, rather, then people aren't going to be able to vote. And you'll have massive confusion at the polling places, which is exactly what happened in 2004, 2016.
Well, the only thing that people are doing that's really different, all that is true. And people have, you know, have written things about other nightmare scenarios, like the guy who was the former head of security at Facebook, Alex Stamos, who's now at Stanford. You know, he has said, what happens if you have one of those ransomware things where, you know, all of a sudden some of the machines go down and some of, like, you know, older machines that haven't been taken offline and literally the screens on the voting machines freeze up like they did in Baltimore. And they say, you know, but and all kinds of stuff like that. But the big difference between now and or 2020 and 2016 and things in the past is a lot of people are really trying to be prepared to document everything. And I mean, you know, because, you know, it's not just videos and selfies. It's also apps and all kinds of stuff. So that if things start happening, we're going to have real-time reports where, you know, we can put forth a counter-narrative very, very quickly. You know, in 2004 in Ohio, we had to wait when the results froze up for 90 minutes, and all of a sudden it came back and Kerry went from winner to loser. I don't think there's going to be, like, these 90-minute gaps looking at 2020 because, you know, the tech and people's aggressive use of it is going to be so, you know, ubiquitous, so everywhere. So that's, you know, I mean, that's as optimistic as I can be. And it's, you know,
well, the problem is that there's no reason to have any faith in the corporate Democratic Party. I mean, look how badly they're handling this impeachment stuff. I mean, it's horrifying. These people are completely incompetent. Adam Schiff, Gerald Nadler, the other committee chairs, I mean, they're nowhere. Richard Neal, for God's sakes, who won't even accept Trump's tax returns, the guy from Massachusetts. I mean, you know, it's just same.
I mean, what can I tell you?
Please, go ahead.
The thing is, you know, regardless of what these campaigns and their candidates do, you know, there's going to be so many millions of people who are going to be paying attention, and one can only hope that that's going to have some sway, and it may not.
Well, of course, he could also just refuse to leave, and I think that the one scenario, and I know this sounds far-fetched, at this point, although I did see someone else mention it. I thought that I was going to write a piece and I'd be the originator. But, you know, the one thing that people are going to have to think about, you know, and we're a year out now from the election, a year, I'd say 1 year and 1 month, basically, until the election, is the possibility that we may have to have a general strike. That if Trump refuses to leave, which he very may well, even if he's the obvious loser, the only nonviolent recourse that the public will have to getting rid of this guy is a general strike. And I think people are going to have to start thinking about that. But let's look in the interim at the actual mechanics, where you guys are the experts, of the voting systems. The key states, the five states that swung the election against Hillary Clinton, and of course she didn't say a word and all that, and all five of these states had exit polls showing that Hillary Clinton won, and she didn't raise the issue, and it took Bob Fitrakis and Jill Stein going into Wisconsin and Michigan to get ignored by her, even though they showed clearly the two states were highly dubious in their outcome. So, we have now swing states that are going to decide the Electoral College in this upcoming election. And I will guarantee you that somewhere, be it in the Kremlin or, some corporate headquarters here in the United States, there is an electronic map of the 3,000 plus precincts in the United States, and they've got them all laid out. They've got the key names and the purchase prices of the various election officials. They know the machinery being used, and it will be micromanaged to make sure that Trump gets exactly and precisely the vote count that he needs, just as Jeb Bush did it in 2000 in Florida, and J. Kenneth Blackwell did it in Ohio 2004. That's what we're looking at in 2016. So the question is, do we have any sense that the corporate Democratic Party, as currently led, I guess, by Tom Perez, who I met, I gave him a copy of our book. God knows what he did with it. Tom Perez, Nancy Pelosi, Chuck Schumer, Adam Schiff, Gerald Nadler, are these people prepared to, and then of course the nominee, whoever that will be, God help us if it's Joe Biden. I mean, really, God help us if Joe Biden is the Democratic nominee. He needs to be on a park bench feeding pigeons. I don't think he's going to get the nomination. At this point in time, I think the strong money would be on Elizabeth Warren. I love Bernie dearly, but, you know, these two magic words, heart attack, I just don't know if his candidacy can get past it. So here's the question. John, we'll ask you first. What, instead of asking a question, are they prepared? What will it take to get the corporate Democratic Party in the next 13 months to safeguard this election?
Well, I think that nothing is impossible if you put your heart into it. I think that the track that we're on is that, what am I trying to do? I'm trying to make elections transparent, trackable, and publicly verified. I'm trying to take away the impunity of a hacker, okay? Because hackers only hack if they know they can get away with it. They have to know that the regular ballot can only be looked at if there's a close election within 0.1% or 0.5%, okay? They make that hard to get to, and then they have elections that saying you have to prove fraud first. Well, they also have to destroy these ballot images, and what we're trying to do is secure them and make them available. You know, I do think that, there's going to be, because my pattern shows that how much theft that there really has going on, how the game is played. We're using consultants, people who know the back door that are beyond somewhat records requests. We see that commonly after. We see that they rob communities of color, like a bank robber robbed a bank. If you ask him why he robbed the bank, he said that's because that's where the money is. That's why they did Broward County. That's why they do Cleveland, Ohio, which is Cuyahoga County, or Columbus. That's why when I went into Ohio and looked at the 15 counties that had digital 2 years ago, 12 were saying, hey, we like these images. They're good for auditing and adjudication. The big three, the largest communities of color, there are people running those, said, hey, why would we save those? We have the originals. Well, they got to save because it's the law. And so that's why we have to try to focus on that. And then we're going to have to try to go into these states in which we've reached out to the Democratic Party. And I think that maybe there could be a coming together at the very end. I know that in my state of Arizona, you know, I'm getting ready to start talking to my state chair, who's a friend. The county chair here in my county is very close to me and Bill Reisner. And then the Secretary of State's a Democrat. Hey, my state just turned 100% digital. Can we make sure that the inkjets are in the machines, that they marry the ballot image to the ballot? These are efforts that we all have to make in every state. We've chosen to focus on swing states in the states we're in right now. And like I said, we're getting ready to go into others. We do need help financially to do that. We're meeting with people who could help us, because the reality is that when we go into these states, you know, it's important that the powers to be know that we're for real. We go in and what do? We investigate, we educate, we advocate, a little agitation to get their dirt out. But the most important part is being able to litigate, because, you know, Chris Hedges is right. He writes, politics is a game of fear. Those who do not have the ability to frighten power elites do not succeed. The platitudes about justice, equality, and democracy are just that. Only when the ruling elites worry about survival do they react. Appealing to their better nature is useless. That's why we have to litigate and go for the juggler. They think we're gadflies unless we can do that. And that's where,
all right,
fortunately, I got good lawyers to do that with.
So let's do what we know the Trump people are doing. Let's pick the states that are going to decide the upcoming election in the Electoral College, okay? You start with New Hampshire. Okay, I assume that the rest of New England will go blue. You go to Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Florida. Now, in this upcoming election, the good news is that Georgia and Texas may be in play. All right, then we go further west. We go Arizona, New Mexico.
Yep.
Colorado, I think, is going to lean pretty heavily blue. Iowa, and who else?
Well, you named most of the states that I'm already in, that I'm focused on, especially the first few. Those are the states we're in, that our focus is on,
you know,
to try to achieve our goal, at least.
You know, Harvey, Steve? Michigan might tilt back to being blue. Ohio, where you have been, you know, probably will be red. And Missouri has moved into the red. Pennsylvania is purple. You know, in a presidential, it's hard to say. If Georgia and Florida should be very close, if not blue. But the thing is, they have very aggressive, you know, voter suppressor, you know, Republican administrations in those states. Most of the growing purple momentum is in the South. And it's Texas, it's Georgia, it's Arizona. You know, it's these sunshine.
Well, I'm going to presume that if Elizabeth Warren gets the nomination, she will run with either Castro or Beto O'Rourke. I mean, I assume that the Democrats will make a big play for Texas. But, you know, so then it's up to you guys to really reveal how rigged the voting process is going to be in Texas. They do have, of course, a Republican governor. Georgia has an illegitimate Republican governor, as does Florida.
Texas is really hard because, you know, it's so big and there are so many different voting systems. And you know, it's really... You know, it's one of these states where the ruling class, meaning the Republicans, there's not a single thing they haven't tried to do to preserve their power. And that's not exactly about to end.
No, it's not. We're getting closer. But, okay, Michigan, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania all now have Democratic governors. New Hampshire,
I don't think, I can't imagine Trump carrying New Hampshire, but I might be wrong. So the you guys are now tasked, you being the experts in the integrity of our voting system, of going state by state in the swing states and assessing exactly where we stand on the reliability of the vote count.
Well, I think what's really interesting and what's going to be different, and, you know, this is what something I really want to do, and, you know, and you've you know, kind of concretized it pretty succinctly here, and I know John wants to do this too, is, you know, as we go through the primaries and caucuses, we're going to have the debut and the preview of a lot of new voting systems for the first time in more than a dozen years. It's not everywhere. It's not everywhere. But South Carolina, all voting systems. North Carolina, a third of it. You know, a bunch of the counties in Florida, the two biggest counties in, you know, or the big metro areas in Pennsylvania, you know, Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. You've got other key counties, you know, like Johnson County, which is where Kansas City is, and Kansas is probably what swings that state's, you know, elections and helped elect a Democratic governor. I believe, you know, I mean, Kobach lost. You know, New Jersey's got to have some new systems. But the point of this is, it's, you know, the point of this is that we're going to get a preview of how operationally, you know, sound or screwy things are going to be this spring. And that's going to be very revealing. And, you know, it's my hope that... you know, people will really pay attention to that.
But by then, it's going to be almost too late. So I think what we need to do is what I know, what you and I know, is they have in corporate headquarters at Trump Tower and all over the and in the Kremlin and wherever else he's got his owners and his backers, is a precinct by precinct inventory of exactly what we can expect in the swing states. And, I mean, the good news is that some states that were not considered swing in 2020, will be swing states. You even mentioned Kansas. I suppose it's not out of the question that the Democrats.
No, I'm just saying there'll be new voting systems there. I mean, you know, the thing is, the people who really know elections and know it at that level, you know, and I don't consider myself that person. I mean, you know, there are people who their whole professional lives is knowing basically, you know, every district in their state. And some people know, you know, every district in several states, like the guy whose files were just discovered, you know, after he died by his daughter in North Carolina that led to all the gerrymandering stuff where, you know, finally, after a decade of people saying, see how rigged it is, and the court's going, no, I don't know, I'm not so sure. Now you have the emails that say, you know, unambiguously, of course it was rigged. Who are you fooling? But right. The thing is, you know, that is the level it comes down to. And, you know, John and I, you know, have seen people, you know, who actually, you know, have developed new software tools that basically use, you know, the embedded, you know, features on these voting systems, you know, to alter their results. I mean, maybe they weren't designed for that, maybe they were, but they've shown, you know, unambiguously that you can, you know, you can mess with this stuff. So that's really, you know, that's the level, you know, that it would have to be operational.
So this is going to be a micromanaged election. It's going to go down to the precinct voting machines in the key states, and we have to be prepared. And I don't know how or if it's even possible to get the corporate Democrats off their behinds, but we need, you know, an army here, a well-funded, extremely advanced army to understand what's happening in every single precinct, at least in the swing states, or we're going to get beat. There's just no way around it. So, and you guys are at the forefront of it, and you know exactly what needs to be done, and we've got to do it. Steve Rosenfeld, I can't believe it. We're almost at the end here. How do people get a hold of you?
Well, Stephen let's see. You know, my email is Stephen@IND.media, and if you want to read pieces I've written, just go to the you know, Independent Media Institute website, and it has links. They appear in all these different sites in what I call the lefty media ghetto. You know,
right.
Probably Salon is the most respectable of the bunch.
John Brakey, How do people get a hold of you?
Pretty simply, it's John Brakey. Brakey is a break with a Y, B-R-A-K-E-Y, at gmail.com. And you can find me on Facebook. It's John Roberts Brakey. My site is pretty simple. It's audit, A-U-D-I-T, like audit. It's an acronym. ElectionsUSA.org. And please do check out what we're doing. If you want to volunteer or contact me, please do that. And if you're in a swing state, I really want to hear from you. Because, you know, when I go into a state, I'm always looking for plaintiffs. That's the first thing, because they don't take you serious unless you know you'll sue them. Thank you, Bob.
Okay, so here's my suggestion, then. This conference, and I'm sorry to miss it in Oakland, needs to be duplicated with the Democrats. And there needs to be a map on the wall of the key states, and a map of the key states of every precinct with the nature of the voting systems in every precinct in every swing state, so that we can deal with this on a vote-by-vote basis. I don't see any other way. I mean, the
and
good
we have
news
that.
Is that some
I want you to know that all exists, is that we can look up every county in the state, municipality, and tell you exactly what kind of voting equipment and what you're up against, and you know, we have those tools available.
Yeah, I mean,
okay, so that's
true.
Go ahead, Steve.
After we covered 2004, what happened in Ohio, you know, I was contacted by the Obama campaign 3 weeks before the 2008 election, and they said, what do we do? What do we do on this stuff? And I said, map your voting systems geographically, so if something goes wrong, and map the contractors, you know, who are handling them. So if something goes wrong, you can start to quarantine things across county and district lines. And they did. And, you know, but Obama, here again, Obama's first election, he won nationally by 10 million popular votes. The second one, he won by 5 million popular votes. Hillary, 2.9 million, she lost the Electoral College. You know, we just have to have such big turnout that all the, you know, microaggressions and micro injuries and equipment snafus still don't, you know, block, you know, like, you know, a
right.
giant wave.
And I've
but
said it
right.
before, it's the millennials who are going to decide this election. The turnout yep. has to come from the millennials. There's 85 million of them.
Yep.
And God help us if they stick it with Joe
was
Biden. Hey,
Adam?
You guys are great.
Was
we'll
there
Adam. We'll have you back.
Or did we
Steve Roosevelt, John Brakey. I'll send you the URL of the show.
Either
Thank
way,
you, our crew in New York. We'll see you next week at the Green Power and Wellness Show in Solar Tokyo.
Don't you know we're going to have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we multiplied, we needed more. The rich got rich, the poor got sore.